cigar and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be home. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channy Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Illinois World Labor Hour is also brought to you in part by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employee Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. Just to let you know, we're going to be having a caller from Chicago call in at half past the hour, Sonia Rotenberg from the Illinois Single Payer Coalition. But to start out, we got a local news story here at the top of the hour. 70 workers at Clifford and Jacobs Forging Plant in Champaign were locked out of their jobs when they reported to work Tuesday morning amid stalled contract negotiations with the Canadian-owned company IMT Forge Group, based in Toronto, Canada. The employees, members of three different unions, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Shipbuilders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers, and the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, said they rejected a company offer of money that included no wage increases for 4 years, plus reduced company health insurance and pension contributions. We are not on strike, said Ron Stanley, business manager with the Machinist Union, which represents 19 of the workers at the plant. We were in negotiations with the company. We voted down their last, best, and final offer yesterday. We had a strike authorization vote, but we chose to go back to work, and the company has now allowed us back in. Just for the listeners to know that strike authorization vote is not an actual vote to immediately go on strike. This is a requirement under labor law that basically allows the union, after getting a vote by their membership, to go on strike at some point, any given time in the future after that vote. Anyway, but Jeff Baker, the human resources manager at Clifford & Jacobs, the 92-year-old plant in the Wilbur Heights neighborhood on the north side of Champaign, said the company locked out the employees after being notified that, quote, the union had authorized a strike Monday evening, and so we didn't expect them to come back to work today. Stanley, the business agent from the Machinists, explained the union's position. He, quote, they asked me to call them after the vote to tell them what the vote was. I did that. I told them we voted the contract down. I told them we had an authorization to strike at some point in the future if we chose to, and that was all I said. Baker said a four-year agreement expired at 7 a.m. Tuesday after the parties had agreed to a one-day extension. The two sides have been bargaining for about 4 weeks. Union members said the company had pleaded difficult economic conditions during negotiations. The company is quoted to say, we must be competitive, both as a manufacturer as well as an employer. We're certainly committed to both, said Baker. We do compete globally, and our business competes in very difficult economic environments. Ron Stanley, the business manager of Machinists, declined to say what the company's latest contract offer was, but he said there are some proposals we are worried about, including the elimination of union jobs. They want cost savings. That's what they've told us, he said. Clifford Jacobs, which was founded in Urbana by two local partners, back in the 1920s, has been located on the north side of Champaign since 1923. The company now is owned by the IMT Forge Group based in Ontario, Canada. And the company makes steel forgings for a lot of different companies, including Caterpillar, FMC, Mueller, and the aerospace industry. So, but how many times have we heard this before? You know, company, I mean, let's go back a few years to General Motors, you know, you know, when it turns out that they're actually, it was their U.S. operations that were in financial trouble, but their international operations were very profitable. And back in the 80s, all these steel mills told the workers that they had to, you know, take these huge pay and benefit cuts, and then in return for a promise not to close the plant. And then within a few short years after getting that agreement, they closed the plant anyway. I mean, these people cannot be trusted. I mean, they're liars. And I bet if you do a little bit of digging and research, you'll find out that the company is profitable, just probably not as profitable as they want to be. You know, that's usually the bottom line here.
Yeah, that definitely. You know, when they pull these records of these companies complaining about wanting workers higher wages or some other type of monetary benefit to, you know, support a living wage or a living profitable living condition. These bosses and these corporations, when you pull their records, they always are making a ridiculous amount of profit. But like you say, the profit margin for what their goal is versus what they meet, if there's a gap in there somewhere, then that's when they start making cuts, because they're still going to have those set goals that they want to meet for their profits for that particular year.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that happening, and that's when you have layoffs and you have cyclical unemployment and things like that. It's because these corporations are basically setting the margin for the health of the working people in this country based off of their goal setting to make as much profit as possible.
Indeed. Now, you were out there in the picket. I went out Thursday morning for a while, but you went out this week too, a couple times.
Yeah, I was out there a few times. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, the main thing that we want to emphasize is, number one, the bosses and whoever their PR person is going around telling a bunch of lies that the workers don't want to negotiate, and they're doing this because they're just, you know, they want things that they shouldn't get. But we know for a fact, even though they can't, you know, they're not talking right now, if you go out and actually sit with them and walk with them, they'll tell you that they've done nothing but try and negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
They are actively trying to negotiate and go back to work, because they're working class people. They live and die by their jobs and going in and supporting their families. So this is really hurting them a lot that they have to be locked out of their job.
Yes.
I mean, we're talking about, they have 24-hour shifts of being out there picketing to try to go back to work. And then, and those of you that have been around in Champaign-Urbana know how cold it's been this past week.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been out there all day for the whole week.
Yeah, 24 hours a day.
Yeah, 24 hours trying to get their jobs back.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're doing this when the bosses have told other workers there to not speak to these picketing people. They've taken away their porta potty, their toilet from them.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
So many human.
Well, I know a solution to that. Walk up to the guard fence of the gate.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
and just do your business there.
Yeah, but just so many human rights violations when these people are just simply trying to, like, go back to work, and that's all they want to do.
Yeah.
But they're locked out. So as long as people know this, and when they hear about this story and spread the word that the workers are trying to go back to work, their jobs are extremely, extremely dangerous. They're trying to improve the working conditions, and the bosses to not meet that profit goal, you know, that they're fighting these workers and taking away a lot of their human rights.
They're digging in their pockets.
Yes. Greed is insatiable, you know.
Yeah, so, you know,
the more they get, the more they want, you know.
Yeah. And I hope people know that they're going to be out there for a while. So if you have time to go out this weekend or next week, please go out and show support and solidarity. It's going to be cold at night, so if you have extra firewood that you can bring them, they are taking firewood. But just going out and just talking to them and saying, hey, I support you, I know what you're going through, this is a very tough situation for you and your family, they really appreciate that. So we want to make sure that Clifford Jacobs know that we are in solidarity with them.
Yes, and in that
workers.
Right here, I have a public service announcement that I'm going to read now, since it's just related to the story, is that tomorrow on Sunday, local organizations have organized a vigil for the workers that have been on strike and on the picket lines, and they're holding a special gathering and photo event, so we can make sure, you know, the media and the internet know the community is with these workers, and that's tomorrow at 2 p.m. And get to Clifford and Jacobs if you you go up North Market Street, past, not quite past Market, Place Mall, you can see a street called Paul Street. It's right next to the Salvation Army, and you just, you can only turn, right, to the east, and you just follow that street all the way to the end, and then, when you get to the end, make a left, and you'll see the picketers up there with their fire barrels and their, little tents and stuff and everything. So if you can make it out tomorrow at 2 o'clock, there's gonna be a lot of people from the, community, coming out there. That's Clifford Jacobs, and the actual address for GPS is 2410 North 5th Street, Champaign. So.
Okay, I just saw that announcement. I just received that email too, please, yeah, we'll be out there at 2 o'clock, so if you can come, please come and show solidarity. This thing is getting bigger. Even the workers themselves even said, we didn't expect to have so much support and this thing to get as big as it did when this started on Tuesday. So yeah, they are very much appreciative of the solidarity around. And, you know, this is kind of what we need though. This is kind of a small sample of what we're going to have to do to fight the Rounders and the others who have this, anti-labor stance. I mean, this is what solidarity looks like.
Indeed. Okay, Gus, so what do you have as far as news this week?
So of course everybody knows that it's time for our big, and I wish I had like a special noise or music.
I'm gonna have to get a little theme for that.
Yeah, we gotta get a certain theme.
Drum roll or something.
Yeah, it's time for our monthly update on the U.S. jobs report, because you know the mass media puts out their job report, which of course is superficial and fluffy and doesn't give you real hard data to understand what to look forward to. Whereas then we're going to give you everything you need to hear. So let's talk about this for a minute, because we're entering a very crucial point in the economic growth or decline of this country and the entire world. U.S. job creation last month, slowed, considerably, underscoring a downbeat assessment of the world economy issued by the International Monetary Fund. The U.S. Department of Labor reported that jobs growth in September was 142,000, which is well below the forecast increase of 201,000. So this is some two-fifths below the average increase over the past 12 months. So the August figure was also revised down from 173,000 jobs to 136,000. So we're talking almost about 40,000 jobs that they reported last month that technically weren't created. Or if they were, they were created, but then that those people were let go of their jobs. So we're talking an extra 40,000 people who you add to not having a job from August. So that's why we got to make sure to see that's not in the mainstream report either. We have to add in when you go back a month and they take away a certain a number of thousands of jobs in the jobs report so people can understand. But here's where things get really scary though. This is what we need to start preparing for. The impact of this deepening global recessionary trend, which if you've been listening to the show for the past couple of months, I've been showing you that there's actually been a downward trend in the rise of skilled and living wage jobs in this country. So the impact of deepening global recessionary trends and falling commodity prices on the U.S. economy were seen in the figures for the mining industry especially, which showed that it had shed 10,300 jobs. Manufacturing employment also down by 9,000 for the month. And we see this across the past couple of months that you have almost 10,000 jobs in almost every manufacturing sector being lost. So the only jobs that are being created in advance are no skill, low wage, no benefit labor, which is mostly, you know, fast food, janitorial services, things like that.
Yeah, but they're not no skill. They're just not as skilled as, say, craft.
Well, you know, what I call, you know, subproletarian work, which is the dirtiest of the jobs.
Yes.
Minimum training needed, repetitive motions and workload, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that would be, you know, the term for no skill, but yeah, I agree. So, the figures are particularly significant because jobs growth in the U.S. has been held up as a bright spot for the global economy. And I put that in quotations, bright spot, because that's what they're pushing. The mass media is pretending like this is something good, that unemployment has dropped to 5.1%. But again, those numbers need to be broken down. Speaking to the Financial Times person somebody who works with JP Morgan pointed to the significance of the result of U.S. economic growth. And I quote, "We've already taken down our third quarter GDP forecast, but it raises some questions about the fourth quarter and whether growth momentum is weakening into year end." So what you see happening is that the projections by the IMF to global growth to be issued next week will predict slower growth this year than last. So again, that is key. If we get to fourth quarter and growth continues to slow, we will be entering a recession period. And these capitalists, these corporations are paying very close attention to this, and they're going to start taking those goals we talked about at the beginning of the show, and they're going to start increasing that gap. People are going to start being laid off. So you're going to see mass unemployment resulting because of this slowdown, and also looking at those prices and inflation and stuff.
Yes.
So this is something that,
and that's another thing they never talk about, you know, is inflation, because supposedly we have like extremely low inflation, but boy, I tell you, every time it seems like you go not so much the grocery store, even that case too though, but other things, you know, over time, you know, automobiles, you know, what have you, clothing. I mean, it seems like it's a lot more than the like 1 or 2% that they try to claim.
You said it right too, food. I mean, you go to the grocery store now, you're talking about maybe 10 years ago, you're spending half of what you spend now when you go to the grocery store. Meat, the price of meat has skyrocketed.
Yes, that definitely has gone up, yes.
Dairy, milk especially. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost impossible to get a good weekly meal for a family of four at the grocery store without bursting your wallet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's just something that's going to be very much so play an effect of a recession, which we're probably going to have sometime in 2016, early 2017.
Yeah, and this is not surprising. I just let the listeners know, I've been, just started reading a book by the economist Michael Hudson called Killing the Host, and really interesting. I mean, basically, you know, we had that financial crisis in 2008, and the solution to it was basically more of the same. I mean, in addition, a huge taxpayer bailout for these banks that basically just kept doing the same things they're doing, and on top of that, the Federal Reserve has basically been loaning out money at close to zero interest rates. Mm-hmm. And at those kind of low rates, you'd think there'd be all sorts of economic activity. I mean, huge amounts, you know.
But, oh, it is. It's just not here.
Yes, and the problem is that bankers and banks and bondholders are basically parasites on our economy. I mean, because the whole phenomena of compound interest and all these other things, and of course, as we've reported before about how a lot of these cities and workers' pension funds are basically in crisis because they bought into these junk derivative that these banks, especially J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, were selling out there. They're in crisis. I mean, Detroit's in a huge crisis. Chicago's, you know, is entering a crisis and stuff, and it's basically all because of this parasite phenomenon in the economy. You know, basically the financial sector is just, you know, drain the economy dry, and it's a real lag on any kind of real productive work. And on top of that, you got these, corporate imperialist wars all over the, yeah, you know, world, trying to enrich further the 1%. So, of course, us working people, we're getting the dirty end of the stick, so to speak, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's at the point to where there's a lack, not even a sense of morality in how the recession occurred and how the banks, like you say, like Chase is doing. Because you have a family that come in right out of college too. They get a family started. Like, listen, we really want to buy this home. And say, okay, what do you do for a living? Well, I make such and such. I only make about $25,000 a year. You know, I'm struggling. I'm paying student loan stuff. And they said, wait a minute. So in your company where you're the janitor, Does anybody in your company make about $100,000? Yeah, well, the CEO does. The CEO of the company that I clean his office makes $100,000. So yeah, so, oh wow, so you may have a chance to move up one day. Here, we're gonna give you this loan with this ridiculous interest rate that's inflated. You know, you're only making $25,000 a year, and that happened so much in so many different cases to where working class people were given illegal and horrible loans that they could never pay off so that the companies can get them in debt. I mean, and this happened on such an expansive scale, and we see these same things happening again. And for doing those things, they got bailouts.
Yeah, and on top of that, the corporate media tries to blame the victims.
To blame the victims, like, oh, they're stealing money. You know, they're taking all this stuff.
They lied on their loan applications.
They lied. No, they were honest. They said, listen, this is how much I make, and they were like, oh, well, you know, it's okay. You sooner or later you'll make that much money. Let me give you this ridiculous interest rate on your loan.
Yeah,
yeah. So you know,
it's like the comedian Louis Black was doing a little monologue on that, was saying about how, yeah, I know you just got evicted from your apartment and cash is kind of tight. You want a house?
That's exactly what they were doing.
They made it so easy for you.
And then
now you owe, like you said, you owe a debt. But I mean, you know, with us struggling so hard these days, I mean, you need these loans.
Right, and those loans, when you read the fine print, they're not much better than the payday loans, you know. They proliferated all over the country because in the fine print, basically the interest rate was variable. So basically they could jack it up, and then all of a sudden people, instead of paying, say, $500 a month, next thing that they're paying $650 a month, and then a few months more down the road, $700-something, you know? Yep. So.
Oh, yeah. Like, I had, you know, I had got a loan from Midwest Title Loans.
And,
it was $500 loan, but, like, I need to pay $101 a month for this loan.
For how long a period?
And it goes out for 24 months. Can you imagine
how
much money that is?
Yeah, that's like, I mean, I've read an article that the payday loan places, title loan places, make it something like around, like, 400% annual interest.
Yeah.
And what else is interesting is, it's not a known well fact, but most of these payday loan places are actually owned either in part or whole by the big banks like Chase Manhattan.
Oh, yeah,
and, Bank of America knows, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
they
try
like,
to kind of hide it, you know, but
the places
is
like
the third, fourth time I've done it, but like the first, when I went in there once, I was paying it off because, you know, I'm not going to go through it 24 months.
Yeah.
But, why are you paying it off so early?
You don't have to do that.
The same thing with places like Aaron's and Rent-A-Center that require credit checks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they make, you know, they'll give you something. They'll give you like a television and you're paying, what is it, like, $200 a month or something? But again, the interest rate is like 600%. So a TV that you can get at Best Buy for like $1,000, you end up paying $4,000 for it over time.
Yes.
And you pay
the,
save. But you know what? The thing is, saving money, which is hard to do these
days. If you're not making that much money, you know, to begin with.
So, you know, you got to go with this or over here or that over there. But the key to it, I believe, is saving money.
Mm-hmm.
If you can, because you know what? Sometimes, though, we buy lots of things that we really don't need, you know, just because we see it, we want it all.
Well, that we could do a whole show on that, you know, about creating demand.
She has it, I want it.
Well, you know, the thing is that the capitalists respond to that because when we do start saving money, that's when they change their employment, things they do that they start, you know, because profits go down then if the American people start saving money.
That's right.
And that's when people are unemployed. So you saving that money means that you're going to be unemployed soon. And that's how capitalism works because there needs to be some type of needs to be some type of profit margin made, and they're going to cut that part of the labor force out if people aren't spending money. So saving money is the issue. The issue is the predatory means that corporate capitalists do to people with these ridiculous interest rates, because things like, you know, the media puts this stuff out that people just spend money on ridiculous things. But if you really look at our spending habits, the majority of Americans aren't spending money on frivolous things. They're spending money on gas and food and bills and things they need. You know, you'll see stuff on television where you see middle class folk, which is a small percentage, going out and buying a whole bunch of stuff because they have the funds to do it. But yeah, most people aren't spending money. You know, and then, like I said, the racist media puts out the thing whenever the new pair of Jordans come out. So what do? They tell their cameramen to go down and go to the shopping malls and just show the line of black people trying to buy Jordans and stuff. And then they say that's what black folks do when they get, when the new Jordans come out. They stand in line, they spend money when they shouldn't be spending money. You know, that's not true. That's called media exaggeration.
Yes.
That black folks are not in line to get, you know, the majority of people that buy Jordans are white people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're middle class white people who have the funds to do so. But they're not going to put their cameras in those malls. You know,
Seen some very horrible stuff depicted, you know, not just on television, but even I've seen stuff that people have forwarded me in emails and stuff. I mean, blatantly racist stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, unbelievable, you know, but believable at the same time, you know, considering if you watch how these people have operated over the years, you know,
I haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah,
just getting started.
Okay, let's see. We got a few more minutes before our caller is scheduled to call in. What else do you have for us, Gus?
Yeah, we got an update from last week's story about the everybody's favorite person that needs to be fired immediately, removed from his position, Dennis Williams of the UAW, and his ridiculously austerity deal that he that he's doing a contract with Fiat Chrysler. So let me give you an update. In the aftermath of the no vote officially announced earlier this week by the workers of UAW, the United Auto Workers, the United Auto Workers and Fiat Chrysler Automobiles are scrambling to find some way to push through a pro-company deal in the face of overwhelming opposition from the workers. The workers are standing extremely strong against Dennis Williams, the president of UAW and Fiat Chrysler Corporation, and saying, we're not going to take this austerity deal. So UAW executives and local officials met in Detroit on Thursday at the UAW Chrysler World Class Manufacturer Academy, one of the many joint operations that have cemented the corporatist relationship between the union and the company. According to media reports, the UAW has not yet decided on a strategy to push a contract through. Among the options the union is considering are shifting negotiations to Ford or GM, presenting the same or a slightly modified deal to Fiat Chrysler workers for a revote, engaging in limited and isolated strike action aimed at letting off steam, or some combination of the three.
Yeah, okay, great. We'll pick up on that story after the call. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Good morning. This is Sonia Rottenberg.
Yes, Sonia, thanks for calling into the World Labor Hour, and you're calling from Chicago?
I'm calling from Chicago.
And you're basically, could you tell about it yourself to the listeners?
Yes, I am Illinois Single Payer Coalition board member and the immediate past president. And I'm also a member and facilitator and administrator of One Payer State. If you never heard of One Payer State, it's a group of single payer activists that represent their respective state single payer organization. And it's a group that is focusing on state single payer campaigns.
Okay. You know, I know Illinois, when did the Illinois Single Payer Coalition begin in Illinois?
When did it begin?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It was founded in 2008, I believe. I was not one of the founders.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that's when it started, when it was founded.
Okay. And so, could you tell listeners a little bit what the Illinois Single Payer Coalition does and has done here in the past years?
So Illinois Single Payer Coalition is was created as a group of single payer activists. It was a pretty non-structured group, and actually in 2011 became a 501c3 organization, and that's when the board was created. It is a group that is still the members are all volunteers. It doesn't have any paid employees. And the main purpose of Illinois Single Payer Coalition is to advocate and educate about single payer.
Okay. And if people want to find out more about Illinois Single Payer Coalition, I'm going to ask you this again at the end of the interview, but I thought I'd get a little pitch in this at the beginning. You guys have a website that they can go to?
Yes, we do have a website, and it is ilsinglepayer.org.
Okay. ilsinglepayer.org. Okay, very good. So, yes, and, you know, I'll let the listeners know that I've been a member of the Illinois Single Payer Coalition for a few years now. And, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, there's been a lot of interesting, campaigns you've been involved with up in, Chicago here just in the last year or so. Could you, let the listeners know a little bit about what's been going on?
Well, we have one of our largest campaign is collecting signatures. We have kicked off a campaign to collect 10,000 signatures of people who support single payer. We ask them to sign our form online. As a matter of fact, if you go on to the website, on the home page, to the right side, it says, I support single payer. It's a form that you can fill, that anyone can fill out. we would love for people to not only sign the form, but also get involved, engaged, look around the website and see what is there that they can help with. We have participated in various debates and various actions which in various events and actions that are somehow connected to healthcare, and specifically permit us to advocate for single payer.
Mm-hmm.
We have supported a play called Mercy Killers, actually in Chicago. It was played as Mercy Strained. And we have actually another couple performances coming up in October and November. All of this is on the website under events. But last year we teamed up with or supported it when it was presented at the American Theater Company in Chicago.
Okay. Yes, I got the privilege of seeing that play. It's a one-man play. This guy that does it is an incredible actor. It's basically about some working-class guy and his wife gets cancer and they don't have health insurance to cover it. It's just a real tragedy, but he makes it very entertaining. I mean, he goes into a very interesting character role to do this. And it's just, I mean, when I first heard about a one-man play, I'm thinking, oh, come on, this has got to be boring. But boy, I'll tell you, this guy is good. I mean, I was riveted to my seat.
He is wonderful. His name is Michael Milligan.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an incredible actor who, by the way, is also going to be in the Shakespeare Theater this February in the role of Iago in Othello. But he wrote the play. He created this role. And he created it because he believes that single payer is really the way to go. And the character that he plays in the play is one of these really very conservative, as he says, Rush Limbaugh listening guy whose ideals get totally shattered when his wife gets this catastrophic illness and he figures out what he has to do in order to help her or in order to be able to provide healthcare services for her.
Yes, and just to let the listeners know, the scenario of the play, it starts right out. He's by himself, don't forget. What it is he's being basically interrogated by the police in an interrogation room about...
Right. I don't want to give the...
No, that's all I'm going to say. That's all I'll say. But,
yes, he's basically telling, yes.
His story to the police. You're like the
police.
Yes. Uh-huh. So, yes, it's, very, very good play.
It's a very powerful play.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, listen, as far as the Illinois Single Payer Coalition, you've got some great articles on your website, and I happened just to see one just when I was going through it the other day that was relatively new here by a Dr. Donald Berwick. The title of it is Why America Should Have a Single Payer System, and I thought maybe I should just ask you that question.
America should have a single payer system because it's the only way that we can provide equitable, affordable, comprehensive healthcare services to everyone, everyone in the country.
So this would be like Medicare for everybody?
It would be Medicare for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We also call it improved and extended Medicare, extended because it would be for everyone from birth to death.
Mm-hmm.
And improved because Medicare today does not really cover all necessary services.
Yes.
So we want to add, for example, dental services, psychiatric services, or mental health services, long-term care, and so on. That's why we call for improved Medicare.
Okay. I mean, wow, this sounds too good to be true. I mean, is there anywhere in the world where this actually exists?
Yes, actually it does. Funny you should ask. We have a country right to the north of ours, Canada, which has a Medicare for all. They actually call it Medicare. And interestingly enough, Canada's Medicare was implemented in 1972, I believe. And up until then, their healthcare services were pretty much the same as ours. And in 1972, when they implemented single payer or Medicare, their costs went down, their health outcomes went up, And Canadians, for even though you will hear a lot of myths about how Canadians come over to United States for care because they have long waiting times and because they can't get what they want, it's all nonsense, because Canadians would never, ever trade their health care for ours. And
yes, I think one comedian, I can't remember his name, in a skit once said that there's more people in Canada, or I should say, there's more people in Canada that thinks Elvis Presley's still alive than would prefer American-style health care system over their Canadian style.
Yes, I saw that. I also don't remember who it was.
Yes.
But, yeah, definitely. Canadians would never, ever trade. And, you know, the problem with our health care system is that it's a for-profit commodity, and healthcare is not a commodity. You can't, healthcare is a human right, and everybody has to, especially in a country like United States, which is a strong and very rich country, the richest country in the world, has to be able to provide comprehensive health services for all its residents.
Wouldn't this be extremely expensive for taxpayers?
No, actually, it wouldn't be. It would be actually cheaper because, you know, all the countries, there are other countries that have either single payer or some kind of a healthcare system that is, you know, sort of in a single payer-like form. And United States is has the most expensive healthcare from developed countries, within the developed countries. What would happen would be that we would pay for it through taxes,
mm-hmm.
progressive taxes. So there may be some people who would pay actually more, but for most people it would be less, and it would cut out the deductibles, the premiums, the copay.
I see. Not to mention, I mean, you know, the health insurance industry, corporate industry in this country is huge. I mean, it seems like you go into any major city and some of the biggest buildings besides banks are health insurance companies. And it would seem that if you took away, basically, if there was, they have to pay, not only are they paying outrageous salaries to their CEOs, they're also paying, dividends and things to their shareholders, and you got this whole profit margin in there.
Exactly. You know, and that is the one thing that I would venture to say that not anywhere in the world is this the case,
mm-hmm.
but definitely in the countries, in other developed countries, even if they have private insurances, like, for example, in, you know, people point to Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
where healthcare is provided through private health insurances, but they have strict rules. They are, first of all, they are non-for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
There are no shareholders. And secondly, they have strict rules about payments and how healthcare is provided. And it's still the same, one standard for all. So it doesn't matter which insurance it is, because, you know, they're really just a payer.
I see. And no one's denied healthcare in Switzerland.
No one is denied healthcare, mm-hmm. which is another problem that we have.
Yes.
This is where a lot of the money is going. And by the way, the overhead for Medicare, and I'm now talking about regular Medicare, as we know that within Medicare, we do have some corruption with it, Medicare, which is the Medicare Advantage Plan.
Yes.
Where private insurance is sort of got their niche into the Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And those are much more expensive. But regular Medicare's overhead is about anywhere between 2 and 5%.
Okay.
3%.
Mm-hmm.
While private insurance's overhead is anywhere between 12 and 25%. So actually it's probably more like 15 and
25%. Yeah, that's a significant more, definitely, for sure. So now I understand that there's going to be a conference coming up at the end of October in Chicago.
Yes. It's the Single Payer National Strategy Conference that takes place October 30th through November 1 in Chicago. And it is the first time that the conference brings together all of the four national single-payer groups, Physicians for National Health Program, Healthcare Now, Labor Campaign for Single-Payer, and One-Payer State.
Okay. And that's that's Friday, October 30th through Sunday, November 1st, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And
mm-hmm.
actually, the evening, the Friday event is going to be an integrated program with all four of these organizations. And then on Saturday, PNHP has their own conference, and the other three have their own conference.
Okay. Yeah, as far as single-payer states, that kind of brings me to the kind of the last topic I wanted to get into is, you know, here in Illinois, it doesn't seem like there's been much going on as far as, you know, pushing ahead on this at the state level. And, of course, there's actually provisions in the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare law, that actually makes it extremely difficult for individual states to start their own single-payer systems. Has there been some progress in other states around the country, though?
Okay, well, first of all, actually, there is a provision in the Obamacare which should actually make it easier. It's the, I believe it's 1332, Section 1332.
Yes.
Within the ACA that calls for innovation and should actually make it easier. The problem there is that waivers would be needed for things like ERISA or the federal money, like Medicare federal money.
Mm-hmm.
In Illinois, we are really sort of stuck. But there are definitely states that are much farther ahead and that are working very actively. So everybody probably heard about Vermont, which was very, very close. And unfortunately, they have sort of a downfall, but they are still working on it. New York State approved has a bill in the legislature, in the assembly, which was approved, actually, that was voted yes. And so they have to now work on the Senate, which is going to be much more difficult. Minnesota has a governor who supports single-payer, and so they are working on their bills. And also Washington State, Oregon, California. California actually passed their bill twice, and at the time it was Arnold Schwarzenegger who was the governor and vetoed it.
The Terminator, yes.
Yeah, exactly, the Terminator. But definitely they are states which are, Colorado is also pretty active. So there are definitely states in the union, in the nation, which are working very actively and are farther ahead than Illinois.
Yeah. Well, I was hoping that this conference can kickstart a little thing in Illinois here. You know, there are a few state reps that have, you know, submitted a bill in the Illinois State House. One of them is our local state rep, Carol Ammons, has been a co-sponsor of it. I think Mary Flowers of Chicago is the main sponsor. So we'll see what happens at this conference. And if people want to find out more information about the conference, can they also go to the Illinois Single Payer website?
I would suggest that if they want to find more about the conference, that they go to Healthcare Now website.
Okay.
Healthcare Now website has the agenda on their on their website. So, and if anybody wants to come, they can register through their website. So for the conference, I would suggest that people go to the Healthcare Now website.
Okay. Well, Sonia, thank you so much for calling in, and hope to see you then here soon.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, just one on my ad here real quick that in Vermont what happened was that they actually had a single-payer system voted in, and the recently elected Democratic governor within weeks after getting elected, after a lot of groups, including single-payer healthcare advocates, agreed not to endorse a third-party candidate that was there. It was a Democratic candidate, a Republican candidate, and an independent progressive candidate that were neck and neck in the polls. They agreed to, you know, that candidate agreed to back off and not run, and everybody threw their support behind the Democratic governor. I can't remember his name now. But anyway, if he would support the single payer bill that was passed, you know, that basically was getting ready to pass the Vermont legislature, he said yes. And then within weeks of winning the election, he completely betrayed everyone and refused to support it. So that's a lesson hard learned, you know. So, we're going to take a quick music break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Daddy was born 10 weeks cure for what's wrong with me. My health care benefit's gone away. It's the lies of the company called copay. Something's gone wrong, won't you tell me why? The rich folks live and the poor folks die. Living is the thing that money can buy. The rich folks live and the poor folks die. And the poor getting health care's too damn hard. Got the third world right here in our backyard. Listen up, Mr. Jones and Mr. Dow. We want national health care now. 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 We want national health care now.
Okay, we're back. That was Ann Feeney, National Healthcare Now. So, okay, Gus, we got the phone call and stuff. I think you pretty well finished up with that UAW story, unless you got some
That's really it. The thing is that the workers have to continue to keep firm against what UAW President Dennis Williams and Chrysler Fiat are trying to do right now. So, it's a battle. But one thing we do know is that they are trying to push through a package that's full of austerity measures. They're trying to reduce the power of the workers. So the workers are really just struggling, and we just got to make sure that they know that we're in solidarity with them as they try to fight their union boss right now.
I mean, this is what's so outrageous about this is that, you know, people who belong to a union pay dues that pays the salaries of their local union representatives, their state representatives, and their national, like Dennis Williams, this guy from the UAW, he's a national president, and they're paying these dues for them to represent them. It's like going out and hiring an attorney and paying them, and then they start working for the prosecution when you're a defendant. I mean, that's basically what's happening here. And UAW, I mean, they're not unique in this, unfortunately. There's a fair number of unions out there on the national level that are like this, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And, it's just outrageous, you know? And the problem is, it's difficult to get rid of these people a lot of times because a lot of unions, I can speak definitely for the carpenters, it's almost impossible because you've got, the members are disenfranchised as far as voting these people out.
Mm-hmm. It's not about the people. You know, that's the main problem. Farther up, lower down you get, it's about the people. And, you know, I mean, I think that they should let, you know, I understand this lockout and how they're, you know, picketing or whatever, but it's about them and it's about us. It's about the people and, you know, we're not getting anything done. I mean, we are making strides and everything, but it's still not about the people yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it should be. I thought that America, great United States.
We can stop saying that.
It's not about the people and that's what it should be.
Well, sure.
About.
Yeah, we the people, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Gus, you had something about some shootings and stuff?
Well, yeah, I'm sure everybody knows by now about the shootings at the Oregon Community College. But what, you know, there's a lot of, rhetoric going around now about gun violence, gun laws, things like that. But what, again, and this is a historical trend with politicians because they're not really servants to the people, so they don't care about the people's problems, but there is a deeply dysfunctional, critical problem at the heart of this country when we talk about these mass shootings. And let's put this into perspective, y'all. Let's do a little contextualization. The killings at Umpqua Community College are the latest in a seemingly endless series of horrific tragedies. The website ShootingTracker.com, which has tracked mass shootings in the U.S. since 2013, reports that there have been at least 296 incidents so far this year in which multiple people have been killed or wounded by gunfire. A recent study by Harvard researchers Amy Cohen, Deborah Azrael, and Matthew Miller found that between 1982 and 2011, the average amount of time between mass shootings in which more than four people were killed or wounded was 200 days.
Okay.
Very short amount of time. Since 2011, the number of days between shootings has fallen to an average of 64.
From 200 to 64.
Meaning there has been a threefold increase in the rate at which mass killings occur in this country. For those that didn't get that statistic. Now, since 2011 to 2015, the number of days between shootings where more than four people are killed at one time is an average of 64 days. That means that within 64 days of the shooting at Umpqua Community College, there will possibly be another mass shooting mm-hmm. in the United States. And that has been the trend since 2011. That's why data like this is so important for us to study mm-hmm. so that we can understand and try to prevent these things.
And this is on top of the huge exponential increase in police killings of unarmed people, in particular African-American
and that's
people.
And that's exactly why where I'm taking this. You kind of jumped ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't know.
No, I'm glad you did that, though, because we're preempting that because we're going back to this idea of a culture of violence, which is a historical facet of this country. Let's not forget that that has always been the predominant way that issues are solved in American history, going back to the 1600s, is violence. Even such a limited accounting gives a picture of a truly sick society. The United States society right now is sick. And listen to this. In a rambling press conference held in the wake of Thursday's shooting, President Obama struggled to account for yet another mass shooting during tenure for office. I quote, "Somehow this has become routine." Quote, "The reporting is routine. My response here at this podium is routine. The conversation in the aftermath of it. We become numb to this." End quote.
Mm-hmm.
So at a press conference the next day, President Obama reinforced his loss for an explanation, blaming all violence on, quote, "original sin." End quote.
No.
That's exactly.
Really?
Now you see the kind of struggle that we are in as Americans in this country. And we have a president that passive and that just so turned off from helping people not die from violence, whether it's by police or by private mass shooters.
How does the United States compare to other countries? I mean, especially other industrialized countries like, say, Canada, Western Europe.
Oh, and a lot of industrialized countries in Western Europe, 264 mass shootings, that would be over the past like 40, 50 years.
Okay.
And even then, I'm actually exaggerating those numbers. There are some countries that don't even have more than a dozen shootings a year mm-hmm. in those types of areas. So again, this is part of the foundational problem of America and how we've always dealt with issues is through guns
yeah.
and using violence to remove people who we feel as though are not fit to be alive or part of this country. But let's just get back into this president, though. Obama's proposed solution to mass shooting mainly aimed at increasing the power of the state and the police. If those of you that have been keeping up with the president, his biggest thing since he's become president has always been to increase the power of the police. Put more police there, which has led to more mass shootings, go figure.
Right.
And we'll talk more about that in a global sense in a minute. What this is, it will do nothing to actually address the underlying social issues that give rise repeatedly to such tragedies. This is a superficial idea of a reform. That's why reform doesn't work. They're trying to reform something when there's a deeply foundational issue of a socialization of violence in this country.
Sure.
Violence has been socialized since the 1600s in American history. That's just who we are. While each shooting has its own peculiar notion, a phenomenon that occurs with such regular must have deeper causes. What is the social environment that produces them? Decades of suppression of class struggle and the promotion of individualism and capitalism, an ideology that explains individual failings or successes as the product of personal characteristics, leading to deep disillusionment and, going back to Marx, alienation. Alienation is key to why America is so fractured right now.
Plus the poverty. I mean, compared to other industrialized countries.
Exactly. And again, that goes into Marx's theory of alienation. That mm-hmm. poverty is so, it removes you from humanity.
Plus the lack of healthcare and especially psychiatric services.
Oh, definitely. But anyway, let's take it even deeper. I'm glad you brought that up. A general sense of hopelessness because of what you just said pervades among a generation of young people who, if they were lucky to go to college, are saddled with trillions of dollars of student debt, no prospect of a decent paying job that provides them with a good standard of living, because a lot of students, and I think it's half now, don't even get a job in the field that they get a major in now in U.S. Collegiate As for pervasive violence, this applies first and foremost to the state and the ruling class that controls it. Over the last 2.5 decades, which encompasses nearly the entire of the shooter's life from Thursday shooting, his name, I don't like saying the names of shooters and giving them press because they don't deserve it. The United States has been at war with one country or another more or less continuously, resulting in the deaths of more than 1 million people and displacing millions more. The shooter has grown up during the war on terror, which has been used by the ruling class to foster an atmosphere of paranoia and suspicion and to justify all manner of violent actions by the state. Under Obama's drone assassination program, open murder has become the official policy, or what he said in his quotes, routine. The president and other government officials publicly boast of taking out people placed on their kill list, including American citizens. This is so key, y'all. This is key because this is how the president and the federal government presents this to the people. They create kill lists. They have a list. Those drones go after and kill those people.
Plus a whole bunch of other people, including young children that happen to be nearby.
Yeah, and we've seen how mass shooters create kill lists over the time of history. This is not some type of spontaneous natural occurrence, and this idea of, well, they had to be mentally ill. They had to be seeking some type of help, psychiatric treatment. That's not the only thing that's a problem here. The problem is that there is a historical trend between how the state treats its people in America and globally, and how mass shooters act in this country.
Oh, yeah, and you know what? Speaking of that, I just watched Panther for the first time. It is so interesting, and it's just exactly how you guys are, how we're talking about right now, how they were with the government. You know, they had that, started that Black Panthers, and they started standing up for themselves and, you know, marching and, you know, picketing and doing all of that.
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I've got a little bit of an issue with a lot of people that are gun control advocates because what they're doing is their solution is let's just let's ban all guns or let's make gun ownership real difficult. You know, they're confusing the symptom with the disease.
Exactly. That has nothing, gun ownership, and that's why it kills me when the president and Eric Holder was tweeting all these things about gun control and all this other stuff. That's the thing that really upsets me the most, is that they're using these mass murders to push a political agenda, because all you see are Democrats coming out saying control guns, Republicans coming out saying guns aren't the problem. So they're making this binary thing off of the deaths of these people. They're taking something that is clearly a foundational problem and making it superficial to push a political agenda. And it's disgusting. And I think that we really need to revisit one of the greatest movies that I've ever seen, Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I mean, seriously, you're talking about one of the greatest documentaries ever because he gets rid of all that superficial crap and goes to the history. That's the big thing about that documentary. He goes into the history of gun ownership and comparisons to other countries as well, because Canada has just as many guns as America does. But they have I think they only have 5% of the mass murders that the United States does.
Yeah.
And there's a reason behind that.
You know, that film is really, two films. I'll start with you, Angela, on Panther. Interesting, that film about how the Black Panther Party started actually arming themselves to basically police the black community because of all these police murders of unarmed black people.
Of course.
And as soon as they started doing that, and especially when they made their little march on the California State Capitol, Sacramento, carrying their open, guns, which was perfectly legal, they passed a bill banning that.
I think that bill was just aimed at hurting the Panthers in period. Because
yes.
What happened was is that they've actually got intel from J. Edgar Hoover, and that when they brought up the gun situation, he was like, but when they brought up the free breakfast program.
Yes, that's true.
That's when he sent in the agents and everything and totally dismantled the Panthers. Well, it was the giving free food to children
that was more of a threat.
That upset the federal government the most, that more so than the guns, though.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, and then going to Bowling for Columbine, what was interesting, Columbine was where that big school shooting happened with those teenagers.
Yeah.
And what was really interesting is the parents of those shooters worked for the war profiteer industry, basically making various weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
Is there a connection? I mean, let's talk. I think there is.
It's definitely a connection. Again, this thing, this is not going to stop. And you see from the numbers, it's getting worse. Every 64 days, somebody is going to murder multiple people in a small crowded place.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? This is what they want though, because it keeps the population set. You know, it's not, they don't want to overpopulate this place. So therefore people have to die.
Well, yeah, and also it gives an excuse for them to basically, disarm us, you know? I mean, you know, whether, whatever you, however you feel about gun ownership, whether you're uncomfortable with it or not, I mean, let's not confuse the root causes, the foundational causes of this violence with the ownership of a gun. I mean, you know, sure. I'm just for public record, I own firearms, I have an Illinois FOID card, but I do not, I hate the National Rifle Association, the NRA.
No,
they're a horrible organization.
Let's be honest. I mean, and if you really want to get, we can do a whole show on this, but if you look at the history of lynchings, mass murders, and the murders from the past 25 years, and talking about school shootings and mass shootings and I mean, the majority of them have to do with some type of economic issue.
Yes.
You know, they had to, you know, back in the day before in the 19th century, the issue was sharecropper versus landowner.
Yep.
And nowadays, and especially after the recession, when you had people going in and murdering their families and all this other stuff, they would leave notes talking about their economic disillusionment. You know, what the political economy has done to them. And again, like I said, it's a very dynamic situation. So for to end this, I want people to know that don't listen to what these politicians and media people are saying, that it's as general and simple as they need medical care. They need medicine. They need psychiatric treatment, because that is a very small part of a dynamic problem in American foundations.
Yes, I would agree with that. Even though some might need it, but you're absolutely right, because the root of the psychological problems is because of the economic conditions.
Exactly. You know? They're talking about a solution, which is psychiatric treatment, but they're not addressing the cause of a lot of the disillusionment and a lot of the mental health issues in this country. And we know why they won't do that, because there's so much money to be made in the healthcare system that doesn't take care of these people. So, but that's a whole nother show though.
Indeed. Okay. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour. I'm listening to Supporting Community Radio Station WFT 90.1, broadcasting down in Champaign, Illinois. And until next week, be safe, power the people, take care.